Good evening. My name is Dickon, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
everybody, but for the grace of God and the sponsorship and the actions of AA, I've been sober since September the 15th, 1965, and I'm very pleased about that. We say that in Nebraska, too. They don't just give their sobriety dates in Texas. We say it for the same reason they do in Texas, however. I was told early on when I came into AA in Washington, D.C., if you don't give your sobriety date, you may not have one. And it might be a good idea if you try to remember what it is. It may not be important to anybody else, but it better be damned important to you. And it has been. And I want to say that it's just great to be here. I managed to get some sun. We have sun out in Nebraska, but it's accompanied by snow and cold weather. And I thought I'd come down here and thaw out, and it's just as warm up there as it is down here, so that didn't work too well. I did miss dinner this evening with my son's future in-laws, and I'm delighted to be here. I'm sure that I'll have to rub elbows with them again in the future, but I called my wife a few minutes ago, and they were getting ready to go out to some Italian restaurant and have dinner and so on and so forth. And I know that you will hold well in my stead, and I have no fear of that. The reason why I had to call Bobby back was I thought I had a prior commitment this weekend, and prior AA commitment this weekend, and I was mistaken. It was next weekend, and so I was able to do it and able to be here because the type of AA that I've been brought up in and type of sponsorship I've been brought up in has taught me that you never turn down an AA request. And by that, I was told, unless you have a prior commitment. And the prior commitment has to be important, not something that you can put off. If you can put it off, you can put that off and meet your AA commitment. And I've done that ever since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think that that's one of the reasons why I'm still sober today, because when somebody wants something from me in the realm of Alcoholics Anonymous that I can provide, I do it. I don't always want to do it. As a matter of fact, I frequently don't want to do it. I don't feel like doing it. I don't feel like putting myself out to do things for other people. It's not my personal nature just to be loving and giving and kind, as some of you have discovered today. And that's not my nature. And I don't think it's the nature of any alcoholic to be loving and giving and kind. You know, the big book that I read says that the root of our problem is that we're selfish and self-centered. And I am selfish and self-centered with my own time. I like to do what I want to do. However, I've been told that when you do something in Alcoholics Anonymous and it's inconvenient for you, that's when AA works its best. And that's why I've always done what I've been asked to do, because I want AA to work the best for me. I have always wanted the best in life. Now, I don't know about the rest of you. I don't know why you drank. It really doesn't make any difference. Our book says we drink essentially because we like the change it brings about in us. We drink essentially for what it does for us. I like to say I drank essentially for the action it gave me. It made me change. I changed my attitude about everything that was around me when I drank. It altered my perception of what was around me. What was around me didn't change. I didn't change, but what I saw changed. Reality changed for me. And it made things that were totally unacceptable to me acceptable, and even sometimes delightful. So if alcohol did that for you, that's why you're here tonight. I'm presuming that alcohol did that for you. And so you're like I'm going to presume, as far as this talk this evening is concerned, that you're like I am, and that you're no different. And I know that there's some Al-Anons here, and I'm glad that there are some Al-Anons here. I personally have a great deal of respect and love for Al-Anon. I have a great deal of respect for it because I've seen what it has done for the spouses of the guys that I sponsor, And I'm delighted. And I'm delighted that it works so well, and I'm delighted that Al-Anon exists. I really am not one of these people who pokes fun at Al-Anon. I don't think that it's something to poke fun at. I think Al-Anon is very important. I think it's very important to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think it serves an excellent part of our fellowship, and I consider Al-Anon to be part of the fellowship. And I don't think that I'm out of line in saying that. I'm not in Al-Anon. I'm married to an alcoholic. I certainly would be welcome to go to Al-Anon. But I've often said that I think Al-Anon is great, but I just wouldn't want to be married to one. And the reason why I say that in a joking sort of way is that my wife is an Alcoholics Anonymous, and my wife works her program, and she does a good job with it. And in working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's really no difference between working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and working the program of Al-Anon. They really are the same. Most Al-Anons begin to be surprised that we do the things that we do, that we talk about relationships, that we talk about how to get along with other people, and that we try our utmost to get along with our mates. And the efforts that we go to, although they don't seem to be enough to others, are extreme efforts for us. And as an end result, we're able to live our lives with some comfort. I believe that the great difficulty that I had in my life prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and even after I got here, was getting along with other people. Because they either didn't measure up to my standards as I thought that they should, or I didn't measure up to their standards as they thought I should. And both of those things had happened to be true. I didn't measure up in their eyes, and they didn't measure up in my eyes. So as an end result of that, I didn't get along with people very well. And Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me how to get along with people, and how I can get along with really anybody if I want to get along with them. All I have to do is to be principled. And I don't have to do any more than that. I don't have to explain myself. I don't have to make any excuses for being principled. All I have to do is to simply be principled. And strangely enough, I was taught those principles as a child, as we all have been. But strangely enough, as I grew older and as I started drinking, I thought that those principles were for other people. I thought that they were for squares. I thought that I was above that. Somehow or another, drinking gave me the feeling of almost absolute invulnerability. I mean, I thought I could do anything. I thought I could do anything and get away with it, and I didn't care whether you liked it or not. It really didn't make any difference to me, because I thought that I was a special human being. I thought that I was above the mundane things like cutting your grass and painting your house and getting your car repaired and going to work on time and working while you're there and going home when you're supposed to go home, not when you had the screaming desire to go out and play golf or, you know, just to be able to work. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I found out the principal thing to do is if you're supposed to be at work at 9 o'clock, be at work at 9 o'clock. If you're supposed to leave at 5, leave at 5. And while you're there between 9 and 5, what you're supposed to do is to work. That's what you're being paid for. So you have to be available to do the work. And I found by doing that, strangely enough, the people that I've worked for in the past have looked at me and said, he is an outstanding employee. He's an outstanding employee. And it's amazing, because I was never an outstanding employee. I had never been that. I'm not an outstanding employee today. I'll say that, and I'll say that with all honesty, and the reason is I own my own business, and, you know, and I hope to be an outstanding employer instead. And I try to exercise the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous as I have learned them in dealing with the people who work for me, and we have a happy group of people. And they work well together, and they perform well, and they do an excellent job. And I'm very proud of them. I'm very proud of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm very proud to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was not always happy to be an alcoholic, but if being an alcoholic is what I had to be in order to be an member of Alcoholics Anonymous and learn what I have learned, then I'm very pleased about that too. So I'm pleased to be an alcoholic so I could learn to live my life comfortably to me today. I was talking earlier to someone, and I said, you know, at this moment, at this instant, I am totally recovered. And I was, because everything was right in my world. All the world is okay. And I can tell you that right now, all is right in my world. And I can tell you from that I'm a recovered alcoholic, that I have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. I am not afraid to do what I am doing. I am at ease and comfortable with you. And I'm at ease and comfortable with you for one very simple reason, because you're just like I am. You're just like I am. You're alcoholics. And although we may be bodily and mentally different than our fellows, we are not bodily and mentally different from each other. We're the same. And we have to remember that when a new person comes to Alcoholics Anonymous, we have to remember that they are not what they appear to be, but they are like we feel. And therefore, we can be helpful to them. And the difference is being able to help somebody because you know how they feel, because you feel the same way, or you have felt the same way. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who have one purpose, and only have one purpose, and that's to stay sober and to carry the message to someone else, to help somebody else. In our preamble, it states it. Bobby read it earlier this evening. And in our traditions, it states it, that Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship for alcoholics, for people who suffer from the disease of alcoholism. Disease of alcoholism is not caused by any number of mood-altering chemicals. The disease of alcoholism is caused and is symptomatic by drunkenness from the chemical alcohol. It's not symptomatic by some other chemical, some other action. It is from alcohol. And that sounds like I'm being kind of exclusive in a way. And I guess I am being exclusive in a way, because I really very strongly feel that the purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous, the reason why it works and the reason why it works so well, is because it is one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. And that's what I'm doing tonight. I'm one alcoholic talking to other alcoholics. And that's why I'm comfortable doing what I'm doing. I don't feel ill at ease or uncomfortable. I don't want to give you the idea that I didn't do anything but drink alcohol. I was somewhat of a garbage can. I would have taken anything had it altered my perception of reality, but there wasn't much around that did that, that was available to me, or that was acceptable for me to take. And so as a consequence, I drank alcohol. Alcohol really did for me everything that I needed to have done. Alcoholics Anonymous does everything for me that I need to have done in my life today. I started drinking when I was about 14 years old. I can go through a retinue of things, and I can tell you a long, drawn-out drunkalogue, but, you know, let me put it to you this way. I was arrested 23 times for public intoxication. I was arrested twice for being in possession of a vehicle while intoxicated. I was arrested once for urinating in public. And since I came to Alcoholics Anonymous on that Thursday night in September, I haven't been arrested since, which gives you a pretty good idea that my life has changed. Neither have I gone to a psychiatrist, and I spent thousands of dollars in psychiatry. Neither have I gone to a marriage counselor, and I spent thousands of dollars in marriage counseling. Neither have I gone to ministers to seek some sort of a help with some sort of a mysterious spiritual problem that I seem to have. Neither have I gone to physicians with some sort of an incurable disease that I knew I had. because I haven't needed to. Because Alcoholics Anonymous has provided me with everything that I need. Alcoholics Anonymous has provided me with everything I need. Alcoholics Anonymous is a spiritual program, and therefore I can get everything spiritual that I need. My predominant problem in life is the fact that I have been addicted to the chemical alcohol, and as long as I don't drink it, one day at a time, I don't take that first drink, then I don't have to go to a physician for some sort of a chronic problem with that. I don't have the symptoms anymore. I don't get drunk. And if you don't get drunk, you just lose the symptom. So consequently, I haven't had to do that. I haven't had to go to a psychiatrist. And I haven't had to go to a psychiatrist or a psychologist. And I haven't had to do that because Alcoholics Anonymous, through the 12 steps, has allowed me to regain some form of sanity so that I appear to be normal among my fellows, among my fellow men. I appear to be normal. And if I appear to be normal, then I'm accepted by them. And as I am accepted by them, I'm accepted by myself. When you accept me, I accept me. Of and by myself, I don't accept me very well. I never have accepted me very well. Because I can look at me, and I can look in the deep crevices, dark crevices of my mind, and there's some strange things that go on in my mind. And as a result of those strange things, if you knew what those strange things were that go on in my mind, you may not have me as a speaker here this evening. Except you got to remember those strange things that go on in the dark side of your mind, they go on the dark side of my mind too. You know, that's the way it is. Because we're bodily and mentally different than our fellows. You know, if you're married to an Al-Anon and you tell them some of the strange attitudes and attitudes that you have, and you tell them what you believe that they should be thinking, they'll look at you strangely. And they'll look at you strangely because they never think the way we think. They just don't think that way. Because we're somewhat deranged. Somewhat. So as an end result, they don't see us the way we see us. And that's the reason why we go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because we can see other people like we are, and we can see that it's okay to stay sober, and it's okay to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's okay to be here. And it's just simply okay. Life is all right. I can remember, I guess I was sober about 6 or 8 months, and I remember I was walking down the street. I'd been to an intergroup meeting, and I was walking out, I was walking out by myself to go to my car. And I just almost took a little skip walking down the sidewalk because I was telling myself, and I came to realize I had accepted and approved of the fact that I was an alcoholic. I had not only admitted, but I had accepted and I approved of the fact that I was an alcoholic and I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it just gave me a good feeling. And I really felt good about it. I think that that's admitting that we're alcoholic is very simple. I think there's a lot of people that admit they're alcoholics. As a matter of fact, I'm sure out here in Kerrville tonight or nearby Hunt or in the homes up on the hill or something, there may be someone in that crowd who is going to say to someone sitting next to them, maybe jokingly, something to the effect that, sure, I'm an alcoholic, but I don't have to go to those meetings like AA's do. Or they're going to say, yeah, I'm an alcoholic. I know I'm an alcoholic. And they'll just keep on drinking. And so they've admitted the fact that they're alcoholic. We have a lot of people come into Alcoholics Anonymous and go to meetings for some period of time. And they stand up at podiums like this and they say they're alcoholic. And they admit that they're alcoholic within the meeting. Some people go through treatment centers, and they admit that they're alcoholics. They fully concede to their innermost selves that they're alcoholic, and then they get out and they go drink. And so it isn't a matter of admitting to ourselves that we're alcoholic. It's that we must do something about it beyond that. We not only have to admit it, but we have to accept the fact that we're alcoholic and be willing to do something about it. And then eventually we have to come to the point where we approve of it. And when we approve of it, I think that that's when we internally become members of Alcoholics Anonymous. When we approve of the fact that we're alcoholic. And approve, not only just simply admit it and simply accept it, but simply approve it. And I think it takes a while, and it takes a different length of time for different people. So if you haven't approved of the fact that you're alcoholic yet, it'll come. I can tell you without, and I've never asked this question of Jim. I know Jim approves of the phone. Where the hell are you? Well, there he is. I know he approves of the fact that he's an alcoholic. He approves of it because he has continued membership in Alcoholics Anonymous. He's still active in AA. I mentioned to you that I was sober for 23 years. In some parts of the country, if you're sober 20 years, you become an old-timer in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have a deal that I have with my sponsor that I call him on every Wednesday afternoon. And when I was 19 years and 363 days sober, I called him up and I said, "Good afternoon, Clancy. This is Dick Martin. How are you?" That's what I do every Wednesday afternoon. And he says, "I'm fine, Dick." He says, "What's going on in your life?" And I said, "Well, in a couple of days, I'll be sober for 20 years, and I feel like I'm getting ready to enter a minority group in Alcoholics Anonymous." And he says, "Well, what's that?" And I said, "People who have been sober and active in AA who are old-timers." And he says, "What do you mean, old-timers?" And I said, "Well," I said, "when you become 20 years, when you have 20 years sobriety, you become an old-timer." And he says, "Oh, no, no." And I said, "Now, wait a minute, Clancy. I can remember you speaking when you had 19 years, and you said, this Halloween, when I have 20 years sobriety and become an old-timer, I know things will be different." And he said, "Yeah, Dick," he says, "that's what I thought then. But," he said, "now that I have 27 years of sobriety, I think you become an old-timer when you have 25 years." So I have this sinking feeling at that point that I'm never going to be an old-timer in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought about that. I meditated about that a little bit. And I thought about it. And I don't want to be an old-timer in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't want to be a stereotyped old-timer in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to be a fresh person in AA. I want to be an active member in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to be one of those people who starts things in AA. I want to be an innovator in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't want to give up the fact that I have ideas and I can do something that I can help AA, that I can make AA a little bit better because I'm in it, because I'm active in it. Most old-timers I see don't seem to have that attitude. That most old-timers I see seem to sit back and suck on their pipes, or just like the psychiatrist that I used to go to, I think they become, we talk about bleeding deacons in AA, someone mentioned them earlier today. And I just hope to God that I never become one of those. I know how they get to that point, by the way. What happens is that they stay in AA long enough that the newcomers just drive them crazy and just bleed them of all their body and soul and get them to go to places like Hunt, Texas on Saturday night to speak, and just terrible things like that. And they just, they just bleed us dry. They come up and say things like,
you seem to know your way around here. Would you be my sponsor?
God, that's all. I need one more guy like, I sponsor a lot of people. And I need more guy to sponsor like I need another goddamn hole in my head. And I mean that when I say that. But it's kind of funny. I have never really refused to sponsor anybody. I've guided a lot of them to people that I sponsor. And I've done them because I sponsor 60-some-odd guys. And that's enough. And I try to take on one new guy every year, one brand new wet drunk every year. And I've done that ever since I've been in AA, at least that number. I have one now that came out of treatment last September. And he's been drunk a half a dozen times since. He may be my perennial, that I may never have to get another brand new wet drunk. Because this guy, I'm telling you, this guy calls me up and says, "Well, Dick," he says, I disappointed you again." I said, "You did?" And he says, "Well, I got drunk Saturday." And I said, "You didn't disappoint me. I didn't even know anything about it." "Well, I, you know." Yeah. But I don't really want to be an old timer in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to go to an AA meeting as I came down here. I want to go here because I'm an alcoholic. I want to go to an AA meeting because I'm an alcoholic. I want to walk into an AA meeting because I am an alcoholic. I don't want to walk in there because I'm a sponsor. I don't want to walk in there because my friends are there. I don't want to walk in there because I'm expected to be there on Tuesday night because that's my home group. I want to walk in there because I'm an alcoholic. And I want to walk in there because I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to keep that fresh in my mind so I never forget the fact that I'm an alcoholic. Because if I forget the fact that I'm an alcoholic, then I'll stop going to AA meetings. And if I stop going to AA meetings, if I don't get drunk, I will become so selfish and self-centered I won't be able to live with myself comfortably. And I can live with myself comfortably today. I am comfortable 80% of the time. Now, there are others in here who may be comfortable 99% of the time, and I haven't reached that stage of nirvana yet, or I haven't learned to lie that well, whichever the case may be. But I'm comfortable most of the time. I'm comfortable 80% of the time. Sometimes it's more than that, and sometimes it's a little less than that, but I'm really comfortable most of the time. And that's the way I want to be. I have a wife that I've been married to almost 23 years. She is the only person I have dated since I've been sober. She is the only woman that I have been with since I have been sober. I like her. She laughs a lot. When she laughs, her nose wrinkles. And she's an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she sponsors a lot of gals. She's a good mother. She loves my dogs. She loves me. She's put up with crap with me that seems to me that's unbelievable. But it's not really, because I haven't been that bad an actor. But she puts up with my crap. But then it's okay, because I put up with her crap, too. And we do it because we like each other. And we do it because we respect each other. And I respect her. She's a fine woman. She's a fine lady. And she's a great gal. She's a great member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't think that I could like her if she wasn't. If she was one of these, well, I'll go to my AA meeting this week, I'm afraid I wouldn't be very happy. I really wouldn't. Peg averages 4 meetings a week. I average 4 meetings a week. We're both very active in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because we like our sobriety, because we like our lives, because we like what it's given us, because we like what it's done for us, because we like the fact that it's put us in touch with a power greater than ourselves, because we're comfortable most of the time in our lives, because I've been a good husband, because I've been a good father to our son, because she's been a good wife, and she's been a good mother to our son. That's a good reason to stay married. It has all of the elements of a possibility that we may be married, we may make 23 years. I mean, it's a good possibility. We'll make 23 years this August. And I learned to do those things in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she learned to do those things in Alcoholics Anonymous. She learned to be a good wife and a good mother and a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous and a good sponsor and a good neighbor and a good friend, and she is a friend. She is really my best friend. And I really, and I mean that with the greatest depth of integrity that I have. Now that sounds very nice, doesn't it? And you hear we heard the Tallies this afternoon. Their story is different than mine. That's the reason why they were asked to speak, and I was asked to speak, because our stories are different. We're all different. We all have different lives. We have different drunkologues. We have different recoveries. We have different levels of intellect. We have different levels of caring. We have different levels of feelings. They are similar, but they're not the same. We also have one other thing. We have one common solution. And the common solution is Alcoholics Anonymous. The recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, are used by over 232 different deviant behavior groups. How's that? You know, we have Gamblers Anonymous, and we have Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous, and we have Prostitutes Anonymous, we have Pillheads Anonymous, we have Cocaine Anonymous, we have just on and on and on and on. And the reason why all of those people have picked up on the 12 steps is because they present a recovery program that's universally acceptable and works for all people. It's universally acceptable and it works for all people. It is a recovery program is what it is. Have you ever thought, those of you who have been around for a while, and I'm going to try not to talk over the heads of the newcomers, but I would like for you to understand how important the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are. Have you ever thought, if you're having problems at work, that perhaps you have a sick work deal and it needs some recovery? You ever thought about that? Have you ever thought about using the 12 steps in order to make that workplace well? Have you ever admitted that you're a bad employee and that therefore your life is unmanageable? Did you ever come to believe that a power greater than yourself could restore you to being a good employee so that you could have good relations with your employer? Did you ever seek employment counseling? Did you ever sit down and talk to your boss and say that you're dissatisfied with this and you need some help? If you did, you turned your life and your will over the care of your boss as you understood them, didn't you? Sure did. Did you ever then, at your boss's instructions, he would say, "Well, why don't you go right out and see what's, you know, take an inventory of this and see what it is and see what you can do to straighten it out and come back and see me next week?" And go back and talk to your boss and say, "These are the things that I find wrong, and these seem to be some shortcomings. What do you think?" And have them point out shortcomings to you, like an employee evaluation, perhaps, where you didn't measure up so good. Having shared that with another human being, you decide you don't want to be that way anymore. So what'd you do? You took some action, and you started going to work on time. And you started working while you were there. And you started working within the parameters of what's supposed to go on in that world. And that's the seventh step, isn't it? That's the actions of the seventh step. It isn't just a simple prayer. It requires you to do something. It requires you to do the things that you can do to change the situation. Have you then looked around and said, "You know, while I've been working here, I've been stepping all over these people and trying to boss them around and run their lives," and wrote down those people that you had stepped on and gone back and say, "Hey, I'm going to try to be better. I'm going to try to do a better job. I'm going to try to get along with you better, and I'm going to do this and alter my behavior." And that's the ninth step, isn't it? Have you learned that when you make a mistake, to say you're wrong and get it over with, so not hide it in a desk drawer somewhere? That's the tenth step, isn't it? And on and on and on and on. And when you're an employer, you work the 12th step, don't you? You help those people that are working for you. you pass along, having had a spiritual awakening as far as working is concerned, you pass that along to other people, don't you? But you continue to practice the same principles that you talk about. So the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous is a universal recovery program. It can work if you adapt it to any set of circumstances that you're going to come up against. Many people don't understand this. We have a way to recover from any problems that we really have, whether they be marital problems, neighbor problems, problems with the IRS, problems with our employment, problems with our neighbors and friends, with relations. We have a way to overcome that so that we can be comfortable where we are. Because if we're not comfortable where we are, we're going to do something to alter that, and it may be drinking, because we get fearful, and we get angry, and we get resentful, and when we get fearful, angry, and resentful, the next thing that happens is we feel sorry for ourselves, because we feel isolated. And just as soon as you start feeling sorry for yourself, then it's poor me, poor me, pour me a drink. And that's what happens every damn time. And it works. So just remember those things. Try to remember those things. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous is a recovery program. You can recover from alcoholism. You can recover from anything if you adapt it to your need. But you have to adapt it to your need. It has all the basic principles of learning to recover from any situation. And you can get along with anyone in any circumstances. Took a long time to learn those things. Those are things that I've learned over the years that I've been able to help the guys that I sponsor and help the gals that they marry and help some of the gals that my wife sponsors periodically. I think that sponsorship is probably the weakest thing in Alcoholics Anonymous today. I think that sponsorship has always been the weakest link in AA. And I think that someone asked me today, said, at what point do you think that a person can begin to sponsor? And I said, I think that when you have gone all the way through the steps that you can begin to sponsor. Because the 12th step says having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics. Our steps tell us when we can sponsor. We have a design for living that works. It tells us when to do everything. You take them, the steps are numbered, and they're sequential, and you take them in order. And you do that because one thing leads to another. And if you take them out of order, they don't work too well. If you run around and start making amends when you're brand new without having taken an inventory first, you're liable to make amends and end up in the pokey or somebody poke you in the nose. Maybe you better show that you're going to stay sober for a little bit and get some guidance on those things so that you can do them in the correct fashion. I had to learn those things. I used to think that I was a slow learner in Alcoholics Anonymous because there was a lot of people around in AA early on when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would hear them from podiums like this, and they would talk about this fantastic relationship that they had with God as they understood Him. And when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't have any relationship with God. And I didn't have any relationship with God for one very simple reason. In my own infantile, immature thinking, I thought if God knew where I was, He'd get me. Very simply. And I wasn't going to pray to Him because He'd know where I was. And when I think about it today, that still kind of makes sense. You know, maybe I could get lost. I'm just a grain of sand. I could just be on the beach, you know. I'd been raised in a church. I'd gone to Sunday school for years and years and years. And I went. I was a member of the youth organization. Used to meet every Sunday night when I was in high school. And I used to go to that Young People's Fellowship for one very reason, very simple reason. The minister's daughter used to go to it. And she was good looking. And she also put out. And I knew if I stuck around long enough, if I persevered, and that's why I went. I didn't go for any other reason. I didn't go because I got some sort of a spiritual uplifting out of this whole thing. Because I didn't. And I really didn't. I would go to church and say, okay, I went to church. Now what? You know, I would quit drinking periodically because the pressure was on or the heat was on. And they would say, you know, you're a good guy, you're a good employee, you're a good husband, you're a good this, you know, you're just goody, goody, goody when you're sober. You ain't worth a damn when you're not. And I'd get sober. And I'd stay sober for a few days or a week, sometimes 2 weeks. But always the inevitable question came up in my mind. And the inevitable question was, all right, I've stayed sober. Now what, damn you? Now what, damn you? I've done what you asked me to do. Now what? Because I feel like killing me or somebody or a lot of other people. I was mostly homicidal when I was drinking, by the way. I was not inclined to be suicidal. I was not inclined to depression. I was more inclined to be manic. I don't know why that is, but that's the way I was. And I hated everybody around me. I didn't like me either, but I was able to anesthetize me. I just drank. And it worked. And it kept working. It worked for years. It worked right up till the last. It worked right up till the last. If it still worked, however, I can guarantee you one thing, you'd have a different speaker tonight. The difficulty with drinking, which was my solution at that time, the difficulty with drinking was you couldn't stay drunk all the time. If I could stay drunk all the time, or if I could drink to the point of feeling no pain all the time, I would never have come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I never would have had a reason to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. But it got so that when I drank, I could feel the pain. And I felt the psychic pain. And I hurt. I'd been married. And had two children. And I came home one day to change into a tuxedo to go to a business function, a business dinner. And I was about half drunk when I got home. And my wife suggested that maybe I ought not to go out like that. I suggested what she could do with her suggestion. And she says, well, if you're going out, why don't you just stay out? And that was the message that I've been waiting for a long time. I've been waiting for her to say, get out, because I wanted to get out, but I didn't have nerve enough to do it. And so I left. I packed up my clothes and left. And I was so greatly relieved I got drunker. It wasn't a... I was not always a happy drunk. I got it in great difficulties at work. I'd been early on a member of the Metropolitan, and I'd been very active on that, and I'd been in charge of new members. And at this time, many, many years ago, it was in Washington, D.C. It was a very prestigious committee job that I had. And I had suggested to the Metropolitan Board of Trade that perhaps they may consider allowing people of Jewish descent to be members of the Board of Trade. And they thought that that was an excellent idea, and we doubled the membership in a year. And I'd done such a good job with that, they made me chairman of the membership committee. The next year we admitted women and increased the membership quite a bit. And I had done such a fantastic job, and I had such good ideas, that I was elected to be the chairman of the Metropolitan Washington Board of Trade. I was a salesman at a radio station. I was not the owner of a radio station or the general manager. I was not a vice president of a bank. And there have always been people like that who had been held that job. And it was a most prestigious job. It guaranteed me promotions where I worked. It guaranteed me entries into areas that I had never been into with people who were the decision makers, not some underlings. And I could have done very well with it in my business world. I got drunk at the Board of Trade meetings. We had outings. I made passes at men's wives, some successful and some not. But I made an ass of myself is what I did. And they had a committee come to me and ask me to resign. And I resigned. And I thought then the world was going to come to an end and I'd lose my job and on and on and on. I had humiliated myself beyond the point that I thought that I could stand. But I stood it. Somehow or another, I managed to survive it. And I managed to survive it because I drank. That's why. It numbed that pain. I had, as I mentioned, gone to a psychiatrist. In the spring of 1965, and it was March of 1965, 24 years ago, I attended the last meeting with my psychiatrist. And I said, "Doctor, many months ago when I first started coming to you twice a week, I had more intense psychotherapy than you get in the best nut houses in the country. I said, I took a battery of tests. And I said, you never told me the resultant of those." And he said, "You never asked." And I said, "What was the results of them?" And he said, "You seem to be," what was the phrase he used, "preoccupied with sex." Well, I thought to myself immediately, I must be some sort of a pervert. And I was. And I'll explain that to you in a minute, I hope. And I said, "Well, when do you think I could feel some relief from these life problems?" And he looked at me and he sucked on his pipe and he said, "How old are you, Dick?" And I said, "I'm 33. And he said, "It took you a long time to get here, didn't it?" And I thought, "My God, I'm going to have to go to this son of a bitch for 33 years. And I looked at him and he was in his 60s and I said, I'm going to outlive him. What am I going to do then? And I said, "Well, doctor," I said, "do you think that I should go to AA? And he said, "No." He says, "You're not ready for that yet." And I said, "Well, I've come here to you twice a week for months and months and months, and I've paid you thousands of dollars. And I said, I don't feel like I've gotten anything out of this. It has not made a dent in my problem. I don't feel any better than I did. I don't seem to be acting any better than I did. And I'm not going to come back anymore, and don't send me another bill because I won't pay it." I had paid the bills, by the way, up to that point. And I got up and walked out. I went back to see him later, a couple of years later. That fall, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd like to describe to you the night before I went to AA. I was having dinner with the boss's secretary. We had been having an affair prior to the time that I had met my wife, all during the time that I was married to her and afterwards. And we had thought what we were going to do was to go to a movie that night because she drank like I did. As a matter of fact, she was a worse drunk than I was. I'd oft times had to literally carry her to her car so she could drive home because she couldn't walk. That's a bad drunk. But it so happened that we picked the wrong night. The movies had changed and the movie that we were going to go see wasn't on and so on and so forth. And we drove to drove to a country inn and we had dinner. We had several double martinis before dinner, and we had two bottles of wine with dinner, and we got back in the car and drove back to Chevy Chase, Maryland, and went to a back to the restaurant where we had started from and sat at the Sidewalk Cafe in a very fashionable part of Washington, D.C. And we were sitting there drinking Remy Martin Grand Fine Champagne Cognac and coffee. Now that's top drawer in the cognac world. You just can't get any better. But I had a credit card, so it was okay. And we were sitting there, and she asked me to marry her. And at the time, I wasn't divorced. And I thought to myself, I had a moment of clarity. And I thought to myself, you know, you haven't been a husband, able to be a husband to your wife. You haven't been able to be a father to your children. You haven't been a good brother. You haven't been a good son. You haven't been a good neighbor. You haven't been a good citizen. You haven't been a good employee. And I just looked at her and I said, no, I can't do that. I couldn't say anything else. I just said, no, I can't do that. I want you to know, had I known what I subsequently found out, I would have said yes. I knew she had some money. But I didn't know she had that kind of money. Because a couple of years later, she came into the residue of her estate, and the residue of her estate was over $125 million. And I would have married her just for that. When she came into that, she quit working, went down to the Virgin Islands, built her own house up on top of a hill, and spent I don't know how much doing that, several hundred thousand dollars. She died as a result of an overdose of Valium and alcohol one night. And I would have been dead right beside her. I would have been dead right beside her. So I'm glad that I didn't know what I came to know. Because if I'd have known what I knew, I would have died. Now that doesn't sound like things that go on, but it was what went on in my life. The next day, I went home that night. I was living with my widowed mother. And I went home that night, and I sat on the edge of my bed. And I said to myself, Jesus Christ, what's wrong with me? Why can't I be like other people? God, what can I do? And I remembered about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, I'm going to go to AA. And I lay down and I went to sleep. And I didn't have the leaping doze-offs. I slept the whole night. I woke up the next morning, I did not drink, and it was customary for me to drink. I would normally drink about 6 ounces of vodka before I got out of bed, and I didn't drink. And I shaved, and I showered, and I went downstairs, and I ate some breakfast, and I kept it down, and I went to work. And I called a minister who had suggested that he would go to AA, take me to an AA meeting, and I told him I was drinking more and enjoying it less, and I wanted to look into this AA thing. And he put me in touch with someone in his was a member of his church, and that fellow said that he would meet me that night at the corner of Fox Hall and River Reservoir Roads in Washington, D.C. in Georgetown. And he told me to be there at 7 o'clock, and I was there. And I got in his car, and his language was mostly four-letter words. He talked to me in my native tongue, and I understood what he was saying. He drove like a madman. He told me he'd been sober in AA for 12 and a half years, and I believed him, because nobody would claim sobriety for 12 and a half years in AA to a perfect stranger unless they met it. And he took me to my first meeting, and it was a cold, rainy September night, and it was in a community building in Silver Spring, Maryland. It was in the basement of this building, and I remember parking, and walking down the stone steps into this room, and there was a man standing there at the door, and he held out his hand to me, and he said, "Welcome. We're glad you're here. Come on in and have a cup of coffee." No one had said that to me for years. Really, no one had said that to me for years. I went in, had a cup of coffee, and I mangled around as much as I could. And I didn't want to be there. I looked in that room, and it was equally divided into two groups. There was 89 in one, and I was in the other. There was about 90 people in the room. I felt alienated. I didn't want to be there. I didn't want to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't want to go to Alcoholics Anonymous because Alcoholics Anonymous was filled with derelicts and bums and ne'er-do-wells and used-to-bes and a few has-beens and some great little old gray-haired ladies with blue tint who'd lead us in prayer and jump us to Jesus and put a nickel on the drum, save another drunken bum. And, you know, I'd seen them. I'd seen those Salvation Army people. I knew what that was. AA was the last place in the world that I ever wanted to go. But I didn't have any other place to go. There was no other place for me to go. I knew that. I knew that there was no other place for me to go. The meeting that night you would think would be good for a newcomer. This guy was sober for 12 and a half years. However, he was backing up one of the guys that he had sponsored. And this guy that he sponsored was a DCM, the district committeeman. And they were having a service meeting, and they were explaining the service structure of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they showed a film strip, something somewhat like Circles of Love and Service, which is not the most exciting thing that I've ever seen. Still not exciting. But I looked at that, and I saw the structure of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I saw, I'll be damned, it just can't work that way. And I was a businessman, and I am a businessman today, and I looked at that, and I said, that can't work. But I was assured that it would work. And I was told that the membership at that time was something like 250,000, 300,000 people. So it worked. Hundreds of thousands of people had recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And I asked this guy, I said, what do you want me to do? He said, I want you to go to a meeting every night for 6 weeks, and I want you to call me every day. And I did. And we went to businessmen's luncheons. We sat around and talked about sex as if we knew something about it. Didn't have a speaker or anything like that. It was just some businessmen in AA, and we sat around and talked about things that we didn't know anything about and ate and had a lot of fellowship. And sometimes we sat there for 2 or 3 hours, and I was more productive in my work than I had been when I was drinking. I looked better to the boss, at least because I was sober and dependable, if nothing else. And I was able to do that. I attended those luncheon meetings for years. I went to a meeting every night. I didn't want to stop drinking. I did stop drinking. I haven't had a drink since I went to that meeting. But I wanted to drink. But it wasn't necessary for me to take a drink. The amazing thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is that if you really want to stay sober, you can stay sober. If you really want a better life, you don't have to drink to get it. That you can stay sober even when you don't want to stay sober. And that's the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it is magic. Because it doesn't seem like it would work. But it does. So I went to meetings. I didn't have a desire to stop drinking. I had stopped drinking, but I didn't have a desire to stop drinking. And as I went to the meetings and I saw the people over and over again, I began to like them and respect them. And if you like and respect people, you want to be like they are. And they were sober, and so I wanted to be sober. It was a program of attraction. And I was attracted to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a conversation with my sponsor. And I said, Buck, this fellow Buck was my first sponsor. He's dead now. I said, Buck, I went to a psychiatrist. And notice how I gave this information to him. I'm doing it backwards to him because that's the way I approach things backwards. And I said, I went to the psychiatrist and I asked him if I should go to AA. And he said, no, you're not ready for that yet. And I said, what did he mean? And Buck said, you still had money. And that was such a cynical answer that I loved it. I mean, it was such a bastardly, cynical goddamn answer that it made sense to me. And I said, well, I'll give him another one. I said, he told me, I asked him when I was going to get over these life problems, and he sucked on his pipe and told me, asked me how old I was. And I told him, and he said, it took you a long time to get here. I said, what does AA say about recovery? And he said, Alcoholics Anonymous says, as a rule of thumb, you don't take one drink one day at a time, and you continue active membership in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you stay sober 1 year for every year that you drank since your first drink. And he says, in your case, you've taken those funny little pills. We can put another year on top of that. And at the end of that period of time, you will be able to then think as clearly as if you had not been drinking. Your mind will then be clear. And he said, then we can begin to talk to you. In the meantime, we don't want to hear anything from you. He wasn't very nice, really. He says, that doesn't mean that you're cured from alcoholism. What that means is one thing, it's really very simple. You're never cured from alcoholism because it's a permanent, disabling, deadly disease that you'll have all your life, just like diabetes. If you had diabetes, you're going to have it for life. It's a disease you're going to have for your life, so you're not going to be cured of it. But you will begin to be able to live your life much better at that time because you will be able to think much clearer. And he was about right. He was about right. And that was a hell of a lot better than 33 years, I'll tell you. And so I like that answer, because in my case, I've been drinking for 19 years. So you figure, you know, 3 years of sobriety, that ain't no bad deal, is it? It's no bad deal. 3 years beats the hell out of 33, I'll tell you, when I would begin to feel some relief from these life problems. And I told him, I said, he gave me such good answers, I figured I could go on to the next one. And I said, Buck, I said, I went to this guy and took all these tests, and I said, he said that I was preoccupied with sex. And he said, Dick, he says, I've known you long enough, and he says, I know what you drank and how you drank. Because frequently I would drink up to 2/5, sometimes go into the third one in one day. And I drank a lot. Because I would drink off and on all day long. And then sometimes at night I'd get drunk. And he said, alcohol is a chemical, much like ether. And if you take the water out of alcohol, it is like ether. And ether will anesthetize even the smallest parts of your body. And he said, Dick, if you're thinking about sex all the time and not doing it, no wonder you're preoccupied with it. Now, I don't know how he came by this business of smaller parts of your body. I figure that was part of the ego deflation at depth. But I could have run naked down the streets and never been arrested for indecent exposure. Been sufficient evidence to hold up the arrest, I'll tell you. But I liked what this man told me. He told me simple, practical things. Like, go to work and be willing to work. You go to AA, you don't drink. You're active in AA. You always try to do your best for someone else. You hold out your hand to the newcomer. You look for the newcomer in the AA meeting where you go, and you befriend him. You shake hands with 5 people that you don't know and introduce yourself to them, because they may be strangers to AA, and maybe they're looking for someone to welcome them as you were welcomed. You never say no to an AA request. I mentioned that I was a pervert a while ago. I forgot to clear that up. If you drank like I drank, you ended up being anesthetized, even in the smaller parts of your body. As an end result, you weren't doing anything. And I have never chosen celibacy as a way of life. And I think for a person who hasn't chosen that life, celibacy is the utmost perversion. That's what I think. You know, you may think differently, but that's the way I think. So I was, in fact, perverted. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a chance to meet you, to be with you. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a wife. It's given me a child. It's given me a way to earn a living. It's given me a way to come to understand a higher power, which I choose to call God. It's given me the opportunity to learn to like you, and it's given me the opportunity to learn to love you. It has yet given me the opportunity to like myself. It has yet given me the opportunity to love myself, because there's always someone around who manages to wrest that out of my hands just when I begin to want to like myself, or just when I begin to want to love myself. I have some dummy calling me up on the phone with some petty little problem which prevents me from becoming selfish and self-centered so much that I can be self-loving and self-liking. I am self-accepting. I accept myself as I am. I'm a human being. I'm a frail human being. I am not always perfect. I make mistakes. I make errors in judgment. I say things sometimes that I wish I hadn't said. I sometimes hurt people's feelings. I'm not perfect. I'm a human being. But I'm a hell of a lot better human being than I used to be. When I was drinking, I'm a hell of a lot better human being than I was 10 years ago, 20 years ago. I'm a hell of a lot better human being than I was last year. And I hope I've had enough spiritual growth so I'm a better human being today than I was yesterday. I'd often question how I would ever be able to be an AA member, because I didn't think that I would be able to establish some sort of a relationship with God. Any sort of a relationship would have been all right with me, and I didn't think that I would ever be able to do that. I've been fortunate enough, I've been able to listen to a lot of tapes over my life of AA. One of them was by Bill Wilson, and it was taken from a very scratchy RCA Victor Red Label record recording of it. And in this he said that he felt the presence of God when he was in AA. He said that he had a hard time establishing a relationship with God as he understood him today because of his own nature, and that he was so pleased today because he was in the living presence of God. I had always known that God spoke to man through other men. God doesn't speak to men. God speaks through other people, through the goodness of other people. It is passed on from one person to another, and I always knew that. I never, however, was able to recognize the fact that I was in the living presence of God. But if you will, just for a second, just be quiet. Don't wiggle. Don't move. Just listen. What you hear, that silence, the nature around you, is the living presence of God. And you're there, and I'm there. And I always want to be there. Thank you very much.